This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to Passing the Picket.
The breakaway rail drivers group, the ILDA, resumed their militant action this morning by making an attempt to block the line between Drogheda and Dublin.
On this week's programme, we're looking back at the dispute that took place between the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association and Iarnród Éireann in the summer of 2000.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker.
Commuters and business all around the country have been hit by the ILDA action. It's now into its 27th day.
Groups of roughly three ILDA members are taking up lineside flying pickets on the Drogheda to Dublin line.
What is interesting about this dispute is that it was between not just a trade union and company management, but it also involved a bitter inter-union dispute when a group of train drivers led by Brendan Ogle decided to break away from SIPTU. As you'll hear later, the impact of the ILDA dispute also had far-reaching effects on another trade union, the ATGWU, when ILDA were amalgamated into that union in the aftermath of the dispute. But first, let's hear from John Keenan from Iarnród Éireann, who is head of human resources and company spokesperson during the ILDA dispute. After a period of relative industrial relations stability in the early 1990s, a cost-cutting plan, which began in 1997, led to inevitable unrest amongst the workforce at Iarnród Éireann.
Our sisters, many far off lands, there is power in our union.
About 1997, Iarnród Éireann, in common with our sister company, the CIE Group, were under quite severe financial pressure, and we decided we had better embark on a cost reduction programme, otherwise the company was headed for a very, very difficult situation. And we are now getting into a situation where we're pushed toward a conflict situation with all of our trade unions and all of our staff, nearly 6,000 staff at the time. What drove the ILDA dispute was the culmination of negotiations with drivers over 3 years, from 1997 through to March of 2000. Within the negotiating scene, we had differences amongst drivers and amongst unions. And ILDA ultimately emerged from what was the National Locomotive Drivers Committee. And ILDA emerged under the leadership of one of our drivers from Athlone, Brendan Ogle, on the basis, this is my belief, on the basis that he tapped into something. He tapped into something that was happening in the wider society, where people were seeing lots of money, a buoyant economy, neighbours doing very well, and people improving generally. And his members, the people who joined him ultimately, wanted to force the pace of that in order to get the benefits of that early. So that was one dynamic. On the other side were the older drivers who would have been 20, 30 years with us and who were through harder times and who enjoyed a very specific benefit as locomotive drivers. And that benefit was manifest in what was known as the mileage payments. This was an agreement and an arrangement which dated back to the steam age, which basically had drivers in a position where once they had driven 160 miles, they were then entitled to a day's pay. And every mile that they drove over in excess of 160, they got a bonus payment. So one of the major restrictions was, first of all, the cost of that arrangement. But certainly there was a restriction in terms of deploying drivers, for instance, on the Cork runner, which is 165 miles. You'd send a Dublin-based driver down to Cork and he would stay overnight and come back the next morning, which drove cost and inefficiency and a whole range of things. The mileage payment was negotiated out in 1994 as part of a productivity agreement. However, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the unions handled the ballot on that. And drivers who had mileage felt that their voice wasn't heard well enough because other grades and other people voted on their deal. And they felt they had been sold out in some way.
In the space of that 10-week dispute during the summer of 2000, train driver Brendan Ogle became an almost daily contributor to radio and television programmes as a spokesman for the striking locomotive drivers. He left Iarnród Éireann to become a union official with the ATGWU 2 years ago, but he recalls what prompted him to set up ILDA in the first place and why he and his colleagues decided to go out on strike.
Well, the crunch issue revolved around the elimination of a driver's condition in 94, a mileage condition, which happened while I was training, and the manner in which that, the ballot SIP2 handle the ballot was less than it should have been, I suppose, it would be to put it mildly, and various promises, including documented written ones that had been given to the train drivers in relation to how that matter would be dealt with, had been reneged on by the union at that time. That was bad enough, but when we as members then appealed that decision or made a complaint within SIP2 and then the ICTU about that decision, the manner in which it was handled then at various levels within SIP2 and within the ICTU just poured one difficulty onto another and very quickly led to us feeling that be it SIP2 or the ICTU, we were viewed as irrelevant foot soldiers to the union officials at that time. Who would make whatever decisions they were going to make, carry out whatever ballots they were going to carry out in whatever way they saw fit, and regardless of what the members thought, they were going to do what they were going to do anyway. That's very much how we felt at the time. So we were then in more negotiations with Irish Rail. I was at those negotiations in 98, and the negotiations reached a point. Now, it had been building up for some time, but the negotiations reached a point where we became very much of the view that 4 years had failed to reform our union as a representative body reflecting our views as train drivers, and it was time to get out. It was a bigger decision than we thought it was at the time, actually. It was a big surprise to us as time went on, just how hostile the establishment, if I can use that phrase, became to that decision. As far as we were concerned, all we were doing was leaving one union and forming another one. We weren't starting a revolution. We weren't trying to reinvent the economy or anything like that, or throw out the government. We weren't doing anything like that at all. But certainly it began very quickly to feel as if that is exactly what we were doing, or that's how we were being treated anyway.
I don't think they were taken as seriously as they might have been, but when they actually took industrial action and managed to mobilise about one third of the drivers.
That's Gerald Flynn. He's Group Industrial Relations Correspondent for Independent Newspapers.
Also, I think it's part of the inheritance of the previous sort of 12 years of social partnership. The idea of a open-ended, protracted strike was an anathema. Most of the unions, most of what they would have done would have been to threaten maybe rolling stoppages or maybe one day a week stoppages and things like that. The only people who had really kind of broken ground in this area were the nurses, who had a 9-day strike the previous November. And then, of course, the Garda the Blue Flu.
From the outset, a major issue for ILDA was the fact that Éireann Róid Éireann refused to negotiate with them once they broke away from SIP2. This meant that talks continued with SIP2 and the MBRU, who also represented train drivers, without more than one third of all train drivers who are now members of ILDA.
Once ILDA was formed, management, I suppose, found themselves in a very difficult position. Suddenly, if I could describe it as the sweetheart relationship that existed between them and their trade unions at the time, was suddenly being questioned. So the last thing they wanted was a third group coming to the negotiating table, unsettling the arrangements that they had worked for many years, I suppose, to put in place. So their reaction to us was very hostile. So they never actually got to sit down with us officially. No, you know, the way the world works, I suppose, people always talk. And there was dialogue at a number of levels throughout all of that period, but there were never any official negotiations as such.
I can remember clearly meeting him one-to-one quite late at night in a particular place, but he was totally and absolutely uncompromising in his approach and felt that we should back off. Éireann Róid Éireann should back off, SIP2 should back off, the NBRU should back off, and the Labour Relations Commission, who facilitated, to their credit, a very excellent deal for the public and for our drivers, we should all change our minds and go his way. It was most extraordinary. Any industrial relations actor must have a capacity to compromise in some fashion so that the parties to dispute or the parties to the pursuit of improvement gain jointly and not separately. And that's what compromise is about. That's what the art of negotiation is about. It's about reaching an acceptable solution that is comfortable and sits comfortably with the majority of the actors concerned. And Brenda didn't do that.
They continued to negotiate with Irish Rail for that 2-year period, and they concluded an agreement. A very radical agreement, which they accepted by a fairly slim majority among SIP2 and NBRU members, but on which we were not given or afforded an opportunity to ballot. Obviously, you know, it didn't come as a surprise to anybody that we were going to have a difficulty with this, and the implementation of the agreement had been put off a couple of times because of impending difficulties. But on the day that it was implemented anyway, we turned up for work as normal, and we were confronted by fairly senior management in the various locations asking us to work this agreement before we would sign on, which of course they knew wasn't going to happen. So when we refused, we were effectively locked out of work then and told there was no work available for us. And we offered to continue to work on our existing terms and conditions while some sort of solution might be found to this situation. But we were denied that opportunity.
Brendan led his members. At that time, they numbered in excess of 100 out of a population of drivers about 350. And he led them into a very bitter dispute with Éireann Road Éireann. They withdrew their labour around about the 19th of June 2000. And there ensued a 10-week, very difficult period for everybody involved and of all the people who had to endure what was a very, very difficult and traumatic time for all of us.
Well, I've been here since 4:30, but the one there, the 5:13, has just been cancelled. We'll have to wait until 5:30 now, until the next train comes. So we'll be home an hour later than usual. It's very frustrating. We arrive in the mornings and we don't have any guarantee whether the train will be running or not. It's ridiculous. No sympathy for them at all.
The biggest problem I find, though, is the overcrowding. They're complaining about safety issues, but they're not taking account of there is absolutely no safety for passengers at the moment. It's almost like being in India. If they could put them on the roof, they would.
Are you sympathetic at all to their grievances?
I have to be honest, I'm absolutely unsympathetic. I have no sympathy for them whatsoever.
It is a terrible inconvenience. It's terrible, I mean, you know, for people with no cars and things that are dependent on the train.
The mainline service was devastated. We had members in every depot. There was effectively no train service from Dublin to the west of Ireland, Westport, Ballina, very little service to Sligo. The service to Galway, for one reason or another, survived or limped along. The Cork service, there was no service from Mallow to Cork at all, and very little of any service to Tralee and Killarney. And down the Waterford line wasn't too bad. So the mainline system was very badly affected in the middle of the tourist season. And of course, this was one of the big surprises for us. We always felt that there were solutions available that could have prevented this beginning. And once it had begun, there were certainly possibilities to resolve it, involving the state's various machineries and whatever. Looking back at it now, 6 years on, it's quite clear that before Irish Rail embarked on this action, two things happened. First of all, they were certain in their minds that the members of the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association would not have the stomach, I suppose, to continue this lockout or to continue to be locked out for any period of time. And secondly, they had got the nod from on high to pursue this action in an attempt to eliminate the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association from the IR field. And our members quickly recognised that and recognised the odds that they were against in terms of the resources that management would put in terms of the various support that they got from the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment and Mary O'Rourke's then Department of Transport. Once they seen the behaviour of the Labour Relations Commission and how the media were reacting to them, a siege mentality, I suppose, befell the ILDA members.
Contrary to a telephone warning given by an ILDA executive member this morning, Éireann Road Éireann said that a group of the rail union members which was assembling has now dispersed. Two small groups of the ILDA are continuing to protest this morning, however.
So how did Éireann Road Éireann handle the dispute? Gerald Flynn gives his assessment.
Well, they handled it in a very personal way. Their Director of Human Resources, John Keenan, went out front. He was in a difficult position part of the time during the dispute. He was on holidays in France and he was trying to manage and respond to the ILDA propaganda over the summer months. Eventually, in August, he was willing to go down a more traditional industrial relations conciliation route. But ILDA were somewhat in the dark. They had really little or no experience of maybe labour court interventions and how it might be handled. And they stalled on that. And when they stalled for over a week on it, that really did alienate them amongst the cognoscenti of the employment relations world.
We're returning now to that decision by the Labour Relations Commission not to intervene in the trains dispute. The chief executive of the commission, Kieran Mulvey, advised striking drivers to use in the first instance the very refined internal grievance procedure, as you put it.
It was a fairly weak summer for news stories, so they began to dominate the whole news and news agenda. And of course, there were the new kids on the block, especially Brendan Ogle. Outside of SIPTU ranks, nobody really knew him, and he became a national figure overnight, partly because of his good capabilities on arguing his case. And he was like a whirling dervish of the media.
The media reaction was the real educator from my point of view. Some of the coverage that I got couldn't have been any worse if I had been a child molester or a paedophile. Much of it personalised attack around myself And then there was the surreptitious stuff. The fact that I'm from Dundalk was constantly referred to. My accent was referred to. Journalists were turning up in Dundalk to pubs that I used to drink in years ago, asking questions about what songs I sing when I have a drink, and all this sort of stuff went on.
He very much attracted, though at the time he would have been very critical of some of the media attention, but he attracted it. For me, he got almost inebriated by the public gaze at that time. Maybe it sounds harsh, but certainly that was my view. He was feeding his ego a lot of the time.
And if I can just say,
briefly,
I've been available since last night. I have my mobile phone here now. Irish Rail can contact me when I leave the studio. So let's stop the nonsense. Let's stop the shilly-shallying and let's get this process underway and get people back to work.
Brendan Ogle, Secretary of the ILDA. Thank you for taking our call. 11 minutes to 9.
None of the ILDA members were being paid. And that was very difficult. And it put marriages under strain. It caused a lot of personal problems for some of our members. For me, it was a little bit easier than that, to be honest with you, because I was very busy. I was travelling around the country meeting the drivers and meeting all sorts of interested third parties and doing interviews. And to me, I was busy. I was occupied. To many of the other ILDA members who weren't involved in that, they were in their own area, perhaps protesting every day outside their workplace. And it was probably more difficult for them. But I had a lot of support at home.
On the line is Pauline Ogle, his wife. Pauline, good morning.
Hi, Jerry. How are you?
It was difficult, I suppose, for Pauline. She rang the Jerry Ryan show one morning. Somebody was on the Jerry Ryan show pontificating about the dispute, and somebody in Pauline's work pointed this out to her. And this was well in 8 or 9 weeks into the dispute now. And I think Pauline probably had enough, because she's not that type of person. She doesn't ring the media, ring the RTE. She doesn't do that. But on this day, she must have just had enough.
It takes another 6 months for them out of work. They're managing.
And will yourself and the other women support them for another 6 months, will you?
Well, yeah, I would.
Would you?
I would. I would sooner starve Jerry than have him go back to work.
You'd rather starve than have him go back to work against his wishes.
I would.
I can remember, like any other family, we would have, myself, my wife and my three children, we would have booked a holiday away in France, as it happened that year, for the first time. Having cancelled it twice because of the dispute, once because it was looming and another because it was on, I woke up one morning to find a note from my then 8-year-old daughter seeking a meeting, a family meeting, to discuss whether or not we were actually going to go on holiday. We did go on holiday ultimately. We went to France. I came home almost immediately after about 3 days. I went back, and I can remember actually going through the airport on the way back. I can remember meeting a member of the public who asked me who I was and then said, "Is the strike over?" And I said, "No, it's not." And he says, "Well, why the heck are you going away? You better stay and fix it." And then I said, "No, I need a break." And he says, "You probably do."
Every week, some of our members would contact us and say to us, "You know, I'm under this pressure, that pressure, or the other pressure, and I can only give it another week," or whatever. In the 9th week, I was genuinely concerned that if it pushed out for another week or so, that a lot of our members might go back to work. And I would have thought that would be tragic if we splintered. And it was very important, given what we'd been through together, that we stayed together, even if that meant going back to work together. But I knew that some of the members were at that point. And I knew there were other members who felt that we should be doing more, that there were things that we had not yet done. So we'd done a lot of things at that stage, or the members had done a lot of things at that stage. The bus garages had been picketed. That had caused mayhem. The Dart had been picketed. Various railway crossings had been blocked. And we decided to bring the dispute to where it probably should have been brought in the first place, to the boardroom of Éireann Éireann. They thought we were going to go into the boardroom in Connolly, because I put that out, knowing that it would find its way back the way these things do. So we went into the boardroom in Euston, and we locked ourselves into it one evening. We went in just before 5 o'clock, so it would make the 5 o'clock news. And we weren't coming out. We brought sleeping bags with us, we brought food, we brought tea, and we left somebody outside with a bucket and a rope who could get food up to us and stuff. And we told our wives and partners and families that, you know, we could be gone for days or longer. In reality, that isn't what happened. We went in at 5 o'clock, and the media turned up and went out on the news that night. And Irish Rail started telling people they'd leave us there for, you know, there was no problem. But once the media went home, we started getting phone calls from our members downstairs that the shutters had been pulled in the station, and the station had been shut down, and the guards were coming in. They came in big, big numbers. And I asked what piece of legislation, whoever it was, if it was a plainclothes guy anyway, what piece of legislation, he couldn't tell me. So I told him we have a right to trade dispute, we have a right to protest at the place of business of our employer, this is the place of business of our employer, and we're not leaving. So he told us we were leaving one way or the other. So we said, well, it would be the other. It wasn't as bad as that, really, but that sounds terrible. But they carried us out, hands and legs and stuff, and put us into the vans and took us off to Kevin Street Station and let us out a few hours later. And then they followed us around to make sure we didn't go back. So, of course, we did go back, but the place was closed up at that stage. That was late on in the dispute, at the dying days of the dispute. And the following day, the lads thought we went back to Athlone, and some of the lads, some of the very, very senior members of ILDA, Finbar Masterson in particular, Brian Dunphy, they spoke to me and they said they think it's time almost. And I did as well. I was coming to that conclusion as well.
In desperation, he led drivers into the boardroom of CIE in Houston Station and took it over. He had supplies reported to be for about 2 weeks, but took it over, but didn't know where he was going, really. Went into an alleyway. It was my clear advice to remove them immediately so that wouldn't become another ugly reference point. But when he did eventually get the solution, he didn't recognise it first and then didn't want it because, again, we get back to compromise. But it was his colleagues who changed his mind, and ultimately it was the democratic decision of the people to come back to work.
Some wiser councils in trade unions who may have been sympathetic to Brendan Ogle advised him, look, you've been out for nearly 10 weeks, you've nowhere else to go. If you're going around occupying the boardroom and things like that and the Gardaí are involved, you'd be better off going down to the Labour Court in Haddington Road. And that's basically where they went.
On the Friday evening, we walked from town to the Labour Court, the Labour Relations Commission. They had intervened in the dispute after we protested outside the bus garages in Dublin, and they had offered to investigate the dispute. So we marched up there, and the guards were there as well. I don't know what they thought. We were going to burn the place down or invade the place. I don't know what they thought. And we weren't telling them what we were doing either, because at this stage, I don't know what way to describe it. At this stage, we knew the thing was coming to an end and we were just going to finish it out the best way we could. So we met the chairman of the Labour Court, Finbar Flood, the man whom I have great respect. And we met him, and the chief executive of the Labour Relations Commission was also there. And we gave them a letter asking them to investigate the dispute. And they did. That was it. We went back to work on the Monday morning. Bagpipes in Cork and hostile atmospheres in Athlone and all sorts of shenanigans.
The 10-week-old dispute involving more than 100 members of the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association has ended. The announcement was made by the association's executive secretary, Brendan Ogle, on the steps of the Labour Court offices in Dublin.
They carried out an investigation, which lasted several months, and they got an English consultant in to carry out the train safety elements. And much of that was very good. We were very happy with that. The thing that we had been primarily opposed on the safety side with the part-time train drivers, that was knocked on the head as a result of the investigation. But on the IR side, in terms of ILDA being recognised or getting to the negotiating table, that never happened. And we were very disappointed with the report from that point of view.
There was a bit of a dog in the manger attitude in the following months. And then things started getting a bit legalistic. And then there was the Irish Congress of Trade Unions investigation over a complaint by SIPTU of so-called poaching when they went kind of under the umbrella of the ATGWU. They'd also actually been looking around for other unions to join. At one stage, they made contact with ASLEV, the UK Locomotive Drivers Union. And one very wise trade unionist over in England said, didn't we do enough trouble in Ireland when we had Cromwell over there? We're not going back again. They were a bit like a lost tribe in the desert. And there weren't that many unions around that would have been welcoming them and that would be prepared, I suppose, to challenge the might of SIPTU. But the ATGWU was, and so within about 8 or 9 months, they were members of the ATGWU. But the management wouldn't recognise them for negotiating purposes. And eventually that led to a 3-day dispute in the following May of 2001. The Taoiseach roundly criticised that in the Dáil. And there are some connections then between that and the fact that some pressure was being put by CIE and Iarnród Éireann on the TNG headquarters union in London. Within about 6 weeks of that, Mick O'Reilly and the secretary in Belfast were both suspended under various charges, and eventually they were sacked about 2 years later. And then after a change at the top of the union and an investigation by a senior counsel or Queen's Counsel in England, they were reinstated. In fact, they probably had the worst experience from the whole ILDA dispute.
So in the final analysis, what, if anything, was gained from the dispute? Brendan Ogle.
Well, it depends how you measure these things. If you're talking about the issues in dispute, it didn't achieve anything in relation to the ILDA getting recognition. The forces we were up against were just too great for 120 train drivers. I think the fact that we were up against a state company two government departments, the Labour Relations Commission and their behaviour, the way the police were used at times, the way the media were used at times. I think the fact that the dispute lasted for 10 weeks, that our members stuck together for 10 weeks, and that apart from 12 of us, that we all stuck it out together and remained the best of friends and went back to work together, was an achievement in itself. But you can't put that in the bank. That's not worth anything in real terms. And the safety element, the safety side of the dispute, which was a huge side of the dispute, it is a fact that the two other unions and Irish Rail had concluded a collective agreement that provided for the first time ever in any railway for part-time train drivers. And if ILDA just had went along with it that morning when we went in, there would be part-time train drivers and God knows what else operating in this country today.
John Keenan sees it very differently.
He didn't contribute one jot to the improvement of conditions for locomotive drivers. Moreover, the NBU SIP2 led with due process negotiations on behalf of drivers, which resulted in a better lifestyle and a better railway. At the time, I would have said this very, very publicly, that those issues, the safety issues, were very spurious and could not ultimately be sustained, as we found when in a unique examination of this dispute jointly by the Labour Court and the Labour Relations Commission, found that Éireann Ró Éireann had acted with our unions in a proper fashion.
I also asked Gerry Flynn if he thinks that anything was gained out of the dispute.
Not really, because what was on the table was eventually what was delivered, and they didn't gain anything extra. And actually, when the new schedules came in and were being operated by the end of August, many of the drivers appeared to be quite happy with it. Suddenly now, that instead of working 7 days a week, many were working five shifts a week. And one or two were commenting it was the first time they actually were going to supermarkets and out with their wives at the weekends and things like that. One wise person in SIP2 said to me that had they given a job to Brendan Ogle when he had applied about 2 years before to become a union official, it might have solved all their problems and prevented this happening. I suppose happily for Mr. Ogle, he has now ended up as a union official, but he's with the ATGWU.
There was a lot of hurt generated by that dispute, a lot of damage, and I think Brendan Ogle, if he were reflecting in the clear cold light of day, would say to himself, it should never have happened. We lost considerable. You can measure the amount of money in millions. It was a very damaging dispute over 10 weeks. And as I say, it's not only just in terms of the disruption to the public, but certainly in terms of hard cash, we lost a lot of money.
It has to be always remembered, this was taxpayers' money. Had this been a private company, I don't believe any of this would have happened. I don't believe the shareholders of any private company would have permitted this to happen. The dispute cost Éireann Ró Éireann 20 million punts.
I don't think there's anybody that wouldn't come out and say, well, there was one or two things I would have done a little bit differently. Was there something substantial I could have or would have done? No, there wasn't. Would I do pretty much what I did then again? Yes, I would. It was a very intense period of 10 weeks. I was one of the voices of Éireann Ró Éireann, probably the main one at that time. I got to know an awful lot of radio studios and got to work with TV cameras and got my 15 minutes of fame. I probably would have preferred if it were 5 minutes of fame, but there you are.
I suppose the question is, was it worth it from our point of view? I think the travelling public, they'll probably never thank us for it, I know they won't. The travelling public have gained as a result of the dispute, as a result of the regime that was being implemented and then wasn't. The problem was 120 train drivers took an awful lot of abuse, hassle and angst for that, and that wasn't right.
I don't have any problem with Brendan Ogle, and nor does he have with me subsequent to the dispute, quite contrary to the public image, though I don't forgive him for what he did, for the terrible conflict, which I believe still was absolutely unnecessary. He's a human being, he has family, and I can say that I have met him since the dispute, have been in his home, have met his wife, so I'd be quite happy to have a chat with him and a pint, but not happy if he were to come back.
That's all for this week. Next week on Passing the Picket, in the final programme of the series, I'll be looking back into the more recent past, the Irish Ferries dispute of 2005. So do join me then. There is power in our youth.